There have been many books on the financial crisis, considered really first drafts of history, books that were written to fill the need for immediate understanding. Now, Alan Blinder, esteemed Princeton professor, Wall Street Journal columnist, and former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, has written his take. It is after the music stopped, the financial crisis, the response, and the work ahead. Blinder waited, taking the time to think his way through a truly comprehensive and coherent narrative of how the worst economic crisis in post-war American history truly happened, what the government did to fight it, and what we can do from here. It is a great pleasure to welcome Alan Blinder to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. A great honor to speak with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Joe. Thank you.
When you look at this crisis, why is it important to wait a while, to wait till after the music has stopped for a while, to see how the dust settles and what really has happened?
Yeah, I thought it was important for exactly that reason. You know, a lot of people were writing, well, not a lot, but a number of people were writing books early on while things were still sort of exploding around us. And, you know, it's funny. You use the word crisis, it usually connotes something, you know, it comes from medicine, a fever spikes and then it goes down. This crisis lasted for years and had many, many wrinkles. And, you know, some would say it's still going on, certainly in Europe. So I thought it was important not to write Act One of the play before I had seen Act Three.
It is, let us first, for people who are sitting, listening to this and saying, well, you know, is it really over? Are we still not in the crisis? Has the dust indeed settled? At what point were you convinced that we were at a point that you could write this with some certainty?
Well, certainty is a little too strong, but with reasonable confidence. I started in this about a year and a half ago. I thought the acute crisis was almost certainly over, and it was over in the financial sense. The fact that we have a long, lingering, bad aftertaste in the form of a weak economy, even though the recession ended years ago, is still there with us. That's in some sense part of the story, but that's the long, long end of the story, and it may be years before that part's over. I guess I define that part being over but when we get back to full employment. And that's a long way. The other place with the financial crisis we hope is over or maybe is just hibernating is in Europe, where there are still many things to be resolved. But in the United States, I think the financial aspects of this crisis are pretty much behind us.
You write about many reasons, many things that came together to make this financial crisis a reality. And it's a term used a lot, but it certainly seems apt, which is this perfect storm. There were so many different things out there that came together at the same time to cause that. And you get that sense very much in reading this book.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that makes it a very complicated story to tell. You had banks making mortgages they never should have made. You had homeowners taking on debts they should never have taken on. You had Wall Street concocting derivatives and other sorts of securities based on these crummy mortgages and believing that by doing that they could turn lead into gold, or at least saying they believed that. Maybe some of them did believe it. You had rating agencies giving the cherished AAA rating to some of the stuff that turned out to be garbage. You had government regulators who had authority they didn't use, kind of looking the other way when they should have been paying more attention. You had boards of directors not really knowing what was going on in their own companies, or CEOs for that matter. You know, I could go on. This was we never would have gotten into such a horrible fix if many things didn't go wrong at once.
Well, and when you talk about those many things, it led me to wonder in reading the story that you tell, that how did this financial system get so complex and so unwieldy? That I guess that's the story, isn't it?
That's a big part of the story. And a big part of the answer is that there's profit in complexity. If you're a Wall Street firm and you design complicated, customized, let's call them securities, though a lot of them took the form of derivatives, that are hard to understand and hard to replicate, then your customers are going to have a very difficult time, first of all, understanding what this product is and if it's really right for them, but secondly, have a very hard time comparison shopping, right? If I tell you I'm interested in a particular Sony television, I can go to many stores and get comparative prices on the exact same product. When it comes to customized derivatives, that was pretty much impossible. One result of that is these things were very, very profitable to the people that were manufacturing them. And that led, among other things, to a kind of a vacuum cleaner trying to suck up more and more of these crummy mortgages, because that was the basic raw ingredient for these complicated securities.
You do such a wonderful job in the book of explaining really these two halves, which is there is the financial industry, and then there is what we consider to be the real economy, the jobs, right, the factories, the shops. And that you could have one crumble and not affect the other one. And sort of the surprise erupted that they were so inextricably linked.
Yeah, I think you could have one crumble and not the other is a possibility, but not a likelihood. I think the surprise here was how devastating was the fall in the financial system when it happened. When it starts pulling down, when whatever went wrong, and many things went wrong, start pulling down virtually the entire financial system, including the bank on the corner, big brokerage houses like Merrill Lynch, which almost perished in the storm. The effects of that on the economy are quick and profound. It's sort of like putting the economy into cardiac arrest because its circulatory system stops working. That's one reasonable way to think about the link between the financial system and the real economy, that it's the blood flow going to the fingertips and the toes and all the other organs. And if that stops, the body's in a big problem.
And as you write, the damage proved to be not only deep, but incredibly wide, and so much so that this became a global financial crisis.
Yes. Yes, it became global for two reasons. One is that in some other countries, such as England, Ireland, with variant Spain, they were playing the same game as we were playing, and they got the same devastating results. But the other aspect was after the Lehman Brothers collapse in the middle of September 2008, there was a worldwide financial panic set off. Nobody knew what was safe and what was unsafe. And when banks won't lend to each other even overnight, and when blue chip companies like General Electric are having a hard time accessing short-term borrowing, that really happened at that time, you've got a worldwide financial panic on your hand, and it didn't stop in the United States. It spread to the countries that had been relatively immune to it before Lehman Brothers.
Because many have made the case that there were these global forces at work that helped perpetuate this. You write in the book that this was very much originating here in the United States.
I think so. I mean, there are always global forces perpetuating things and linking countries to countries. So none of us, including the United States, is sort of a walled-off island. That said, this crisis was very much made in America. We can't blame other countries for this. We did it. The international propagation was much more emanating from the United States to the rest of the world than from the rest of the world back onto the United States.
One of the most fascinating themes of the book is ultimately what did not happen, that the worst did not happen. At what point did that begin, going back to an earlier question, but at what point did that become apparent that whatever we were doing was successful in keeping that worse from happening?
I think probably around the spring of 2009. By then, we had the TARP, which passed in early October 2008 and really started doing things that month and in the following months, the closing months of the Bush administration. We had had the big fiscal stimulus package, which was the first major piece of legislation of the Obama administration in February 2009. And then the other important member of the triumvirate, which gets almost no attention outside the experts, is the so-called stress tests of the major banks and other financial institutions that were conducted, were sort of designed by the Treasury and the Fed and conducted by the Fed and other bank regulators in the spring of 2009, which I like to compare, although in detail they were extremely different, to the bank holiday that Franklin Roosevelt declared in 1933 during the worst of the panic in the Great Depression. It told people, it examined these banks, that's the medical analogy to a stress test, and found them healthy enough to survive. I wouldn't say healthy, but healthy enough to survive, and basically announced to the whole world, including not least the depositors of these banks, that they were safe to deal with. And things started to improve after that.
Where does trust come in?
Trust is huge. This was the fundamental problem. One way to look at this is that the surprise collapse of Lehman Brothers in the middle of September 2008, and it was a surprise, destroyed trust in financial institutions all over the country and all over the world. And the house of cards just crumbled. One thing tumbled after another. The TARP, which injected capital into banks to prop them up, and the stress tests that I was just talking about, which gave the banks, you know, I don't want to say a clean bill of health, but a reasonable bill of health, really went a long way to reestablish the trust that had been shattered, because the financial system fundamentally functions on two things, electrons and trust.
As you stated a moment ago, why do you think the stress tests were so overlooked as a part of this equation, an important
part of this equation? It's extremely wonkish. People don't know what it means. They don't really know how banks work or what their balance sheets look like. This kind of thing that experts dote on much more than ordinary people. And it didn't get the kind of publicity, part of which you get negatively from politics, by the way, that the TARP got and the stimulus program got. I'm sure if you did a Google search on those two things at the time, it was just tens of thousands of entries. And if you did the same on the bank stress tests when they were going on, it would have been a tiny fraction of those. It just wasn't so much in the public eye. But believe me, it was in the eye of the financial system. Financial market participants were watching it very, very closely, and it was done very, very well.
As you write in the book, where do we go from here? The only honest answer is nobody knows.
Right. Nobody does know. There are, as you know, and as the whole country knows, plenty of threats still in the fiscal position in the United States. We narrowly avoided the fiscal cliff. It looks now like the debt ceiling crisis will be put off for a few months, and that's a good thing. Hopefully we'll never have it, but it's a huge hazard to the U.S. economy and indeed to the world economy if we ever actually crash into the debt ceiling. We don't know how the budget situation is going to be resolved. I mean, everybody knows we got to shrink the deficit. Nobody agrees on how. There are still hazards in Europe, and I mean by that the Eurozone mainly, that need to be resolved. And there is the issue of what's called the Fed's exit strategy. That is to say, the Fed did all these very unusual things, bringing interest rates to zero, buying assets it had never bought before, blowing up its balance sheet, and so on. The Fed has stated very clearly it needs to get out of those things eventually. The key word there is eventually.
You write in the book, with the economy still so weak, the case for near-term fiscal contraction is weak as well. We shouldn't kick away the fiscal crutch until the patient is ready to walk. If I'm allowed to indulge in wishful thinking, a two-pronged policy that combines modest fiscal stimulus up front with serious deficit reduction thereafter would be even better. The chances for that, you think, are what?
A snowball's chance in hell, I think. This is a magic wand thought. If I could wave a magic wand, that's what I would make happen. But one of the very sad legacies of this crisis that we were alluding to before is that the word stimulus has become a dirty word. I mean, even if you think it's a good idea, you can't use that term politically. Economists still use that term all the time. But proposing a stimulus is going to lead to elicit a Bronx cheer out of the U.S. Congress. I'm not even sure how many Democrats would support it, and certainly the Republicans would be 100% united against it. So, you know, the right remedy, and, you know, some Republican economists have even said this, this is not like a unique idea for me, would be to combine a modest-sized stimulus. So for argument's sake, let's say $400 to $500 billion of additional spending and tax cuts, all temporary, with an immodestly sized deficit reduction package that might be 8 to 10 times that size. So in the modern Washington language, we, quote, pay for the stimulus 8 to 10 times over. But it's delayed. The payment is delayed. So first you get the stimulus, and then maybe in a year and a half to 2 years, you start paying for it with higher taxes, lower spending, and so on. But, you know, politically, I think it's a pretty much an impossible sell.
Politically, how important is the president in this equation in the sense of getting something done that is not the magic wand, but is perhaps as close as we can get?
I think the president is hugely important, as many, many people, including many members of Congress, have said. You don't really get leadership out of Congress. You got 100 senators, 435 members of Congress. If there's going to be a leader, especially in a complex issue, it almost has to be the president. But, of course, paradoxically, the president can only suggest, cajole, maybe bend some arms if he's a good manipulative president. But he doesn't have a single vote in the Congress himself. And when it comes to spending money, cutting programs, adding to programs, raising taxes, reforming the tax code, any of that, it's all the Congress. The president can't do any of that on his own.
With that said, do we learn lessons? You address this in the book about lessons learned in for the future.
I sure hope we do. And, you know, only time will tell. You started by asking about undue complexity, and I hope that's one lesson that we learn. Second lesson is there was too much leverage, too much overborrowing all over the system by households, by banks, by Wall Street firms, by the so-called shadow banking system, just everywhere. And leverage is dangerous. When things go bad, it can really backfire on you. I hope we learned to keep a sharper regulatory eye on the financial system, and the Dodd-Frank Act will help. I hope, and here I really underscore hope, that corporate boards of directors learned that they have to pay more attention to what's going on, especially to risk management, because a lot of the companies right under their noses took tremendous undue risks that turned out to backfire. I mean, if it all worked out fine, they would have made a lot of money, but it didn't all work out fine. And, you know, you could go on and on with lessons that I and many other people hope we learned. And I might add, maybe the biggest thing that I hope for is I hope we didn't learn lessons that are false, such as the stimulus didn't work, the TARP didn't work, the stress test didn't work, and so on. All of that is quite wrong, but if people have mistakenly learned those lessons, we're going to have a very hard time dealing with the next big financial ruction. You know, and that, in some sense, is my biggest worry.
And what about we, the people, the American people? Do you think we learned something in this of the fragility of a system? And we talked about trust, but allow us to be a little more savvy.
Well, I hope so. But, you know, one thing I'm pretty sure of is there will be another big financial bubble sometime. I hope it's not soon, and I certainly don't know what it'll be in. It probably won't be in housing for a while because people really got burned on that. But bubbles in financial markets have been happening for as long as there have been financial markets. So I really don't believe that we've learned that. What I hope we've done is built in a sturdier system, partly because of Dodd-Frank and partly because of reforms of the regulatory system itself, including the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Alan Blinder is a Princeton professor of economics and public affairs. He's also a Wall Street Journal columnist and former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. The new book is After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead. The book is published by the Penguin Press. Alan Blinder, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It was all my pleasure.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead, published by the Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.